Well, thank you very much. It's just a great honor to be here to listen to the people and meet the people and talk to all these about these things. And it's to be invited to speak is just above, you know, my expectations. So I'm very honored and thank you very much for having me here. I'm here today because over 20 years ago, I helped report in near real time the lies being told by the Pentagon political appointees and the White House. My first published essays were a series of snarky notes on Colonel David Hackworth's Soldiers for the Truth website beginning in August of 2002. Lou Rockwell may remember this. It was through Lou Rockwell that I discovered other dissenting voices, reminding us of what we now know about every war the U.S. government has pursued. I emailed Lou from my DOD email with a sample, but I asked that if published, it had to be anonymously. He didn't know me. It would be years later before we actually met in person, and he told me I would have to use my name, not anonymous, and not use a pseudonym. That rejection was a blessing in disguise. By contacting Colonel Hackworth and having his instant confirmation that what I was saying and seeing made me a legitimate soldier for the truth, my earliest audience included many active duty military and veterans in and outside of the Pentagon and certain mainstream journalists looking for whistleblowers. Long after I retired, I realized why Colonel Hackworth would have given me that audience and anonymity. He had already been hearing much of the same thing from his many other contacts inside and outside the Pentagon. And he knew, as a man cut from the same cloth as Lieutenant General Smedley Butler, that the true history of American war was consistent with what I was observing inside the Pentagon. It was the 21st century before I had ever read War is a Racket. Despite completing the Naval War College program and spending 19 years in the U.S. Air Force, I was never taught about, nor exposed to, Smedley Butler. It was as if this decorated Marine did not merit a footnote in the official bibliography. Butler and Hackworth were highly decorated fighting men who provided the same message to us and to their chain of command while serving and after retirement. They are role models for all Americans, tough, courageous, and honest. Most importantly, they retained their ability to think independently, to look at the reality of their world critically, and for lack of a better phrase, to do the right thing, to act. Colonel Hackworth was forced to retire in 1971, shortly after he spoke out on June 27th of that year on the ABC program Issues and Answers. Hackworth criticized how the Vietnam War was being led and conducted, said it was unwinnable, and publicly called for a withdrawal of U.S. troops. This was just a few weeks after the very first excerpts of the Dan Ellsberg and Anthony Russo Pentagon Papers were published in the New York Times. The 47 volumes covered U.S. government plans and activities relating to the Vietnam War beginning as early as the 1940s. They revealed the outrageous duplicity between what Americans were told about the war their sons were being deployed to and what it was really about and what was really happening. Among other things, these papers revealed the key role played by the U.S. in the 1963 coup in South Vietnam, in which Diem was assassinated, one of the many constants in my very typical American life has been U.S. intelligence agency and Pentagon-supported coups, apparently on a rinse-and-repeat cycle. What happened to Diem in 1963 was standard operating procedure. It would not surprise me today that several CIA and Pentagon-coordinated regime changes are in the works as we speak. By the mid-1970s, the New York Times had published only about 5% of the 7,000 pages of the RAND Corporation's Vietnam study and its supporting documents. Bits and pieces of this study were published later, and in 2002, the National Security Archives published the remainder. The study itself was not declassified until 2011. The truth of what Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson administrations had done and how those administrations misled the public took more than 30 years after the Ellsberg leaks had been front page news to be declassified. It took 30 years. The persistent, never-ending denial of what it has done speaks to a number of aspects of our government. Spineless, unaccountable, devious, and lazy come to mind, but the bureaucracy's reluctance to confess its intentional lies, its calculated manipulation, and its tax-funded arson speaks to the state's absolute and unbounded terror of an informed and alert citizenry. In the face of revisionist history, the informed and objective analysis of what governments did, to include what it is lying about today and planning to lie about tomorrow, government has one tool, one response: debase, deface, silence, and punish those involved in revealing the truth. Government bureaucracies do not follow a 12-step program. They acknowledge no higher power than themselves. They consider their lies preferable to the truth, arrogance more useful than humility. Instead of showing courage, they are cowards and thieves, afraid to honestly face the American people who fuel it with blood, money, and what's left of American honor. If and when the truth comes out, if a credible 10th man sanity check is conducted, or a dissenter is identified at any level, the bureaucracy labels the leak to be the work of the disgruntled, the unpatriotic, the incompetent. This was me in 2002. I almost couldn't believe what I was seeing. I was so amazed and disturbed about it that I wondered if maybe I was just wrong. I was active duty, less than a year from retirement, working in the Near East South Asia directory of the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and I wasn't sharing classified information. I was just making fun of my masters. I was pointing out their real agenda for war, their active propaganda campaign aimed at Congress and the American people. The desired war to kill Saddam Hussein and destroy Iraq as a functioning entity, like many needless and expensive wars before and after, had already been planned, approved, and consented to by our political masters. The Pentagon was logistically executing this war by May of 2002, and all that remained was to gin up the popular appetite. As we know from the wars fought by General Smedley Butler and those fought by Colonel Hackworth, once started, they are hard to stop. And the lies that were necessary to popularize them become top secret, permanent, and later written in the textbooks. Those invested in the war machinery of the United States watch their profits rise as the rest of us see our security collapse and our liberty shrink. The Pentagon was lying. I didn't just know it was lying. I could see and compare the actual intelligence we had to what we were putting out to the press in Washington for their specific use in media, think tank, and congressional war pimping. When I asked my uniform coworkers, they agreed with me that the Office of Special Plans and their bosses, up to and including Rumsfeld, were indeed fabricating and cherry-picking random and often previously disqualified reporting to create a false storyline to justify the imminent invasion of Iraq, to fulfill a neoconservative agenda of permanently militarily and politically debilitating any and all of Israel's neighbors, not because this was good for the U.S. or even good for Israel, but because the Zionist government in Tel Aviv and its American cheerleaders wanted it. The plan for toppling the governments and destroying the militaries of Iraq, Syria, Libya are connected because they stem from the same warped political desire drafted and executed on behalf of a narrow Zionist vision for the Middle East. Of course, had the Pentagon told the truth, the American people would never have supported the war, and Congress, despite AIPAC and defense industry pressures, would not and could not have executed it. There's a reason the United States Congress no longer declares war. The intelligence and assumptions upon which such a declaration rests become a matter of public record in real time. Votes for the war recorded, and truth gets a toehold that can serve both anti-war and realist sectors of American society. If truth gets a toehold, we get the beginning of an informed citizenry. We get legitimate and fearless discussions and debates throughout that society about whatever disaster the government is advocating. Even with the most recent congressionally declared war, one that we joined over 80 years ago, Americans have discovered through decades of research, revelation, and revisionism that the facts of that war must, not just in certain cases or instances, but in every case, be prefaced by the word so-called or presumed. Public assumptions were shaped and propagandized as a rule, not as an exception. Individual and government double-dealing, decision-making, and motivations in most cases remained hidden from public view. Our American experience with World War II did demonstrate the power of public propaganda through information technology and art, but even then, technology was shortening the lifespan of that propaganda. Even then, the marketplace of stories, ideas, and imagery proved hard to control, and it's much harder to control today. Conflict propaganda and manufacturing consent is as necessary for the state as it is for any other gang. We see this then as now, whether the topic is a state's mass murder in war or the approved identification of criminal sectors here at home. We see it in the language of wars on fill in the blank. And we see it in government programs of identity controls, inoculations, and surveillance. We see this language of war in state-dominated and designed mechanisms of free trade. George Washington is credited with saying that government is not reason, it is not eloquence, it is force. But imagine the opposite. Imagine the Congress and the White House applying reason, which would necessarily invoke both the Constitution and human ethics, and then debating eloquently a decision to start or join a war, an intervention, conduct a coup in a foreign country, an assassination of an enemy abroad or at home. Most of us cannot imagine this. When and if reason and eloquence is applied to state decisions and actions, the herd mentality is blown apart. People begin to believe that their observations and perceptions have value. Reason and the eloquence of truth destroys any possibility of mass obedience, and this is antithetical to the state. Today, the propaganda game of the state is being challenged. The lifespan of state lies is being shortened, and the ability of the state to adapt to this problem is being severely constrained by technology. All of this is cause for celebration. The idea that government lies, that governments lie, is not new, but I will quote from a short article by Gordon Adams of American University. In 2019, the Washington Post published what they called the Afghanistan Papers, revealing that the American public had been lied to for 18 years about the U.S. success in its Afghanistan project. Adams compares the lack of popular shock upon the revelation about U.S. failure in and lies about Afghanistan and compares it to what happened in 1971 when over 200 million Americans, those who had not been deployed to Vietnam, were appalled and angered at the degree of national and egregious deception conducted by multiple U.S. administrations. Adams laments that the mild reaction to lying in plain sight about Afghanistan suggests that the U.S. may be well down the road to unraveling government's credibility and our democracy altogether. Today, it takes less than a day for the majority to discover that a U.S. state proclamation on nearly any topic was a lie. It happens so often, whatever the U.S. government says must usually be rotated 180 degrees to be believed. The psychological term projection is commonly applied when trying to understand what our government and others are saying. The current illegal war on the Houthis in Yemen is a good example of this. Central Command is quick to report no problems, but unlike 80 or even 20 years ago, we have imagery and counter-reporting that not only reveals what happened and is happening, but often forces the U.S. government to change its own narrative in near real time. The natural and ancient tendencies of government is to lie and to propagandize, to stay on top, its power unquestioned and unlimited. At the same time, uniquely American ideas about individual liberty and modern technology combine to empower individuals and communities to create, to produce, to frequently check their premises, and to reason. State centralization and state-demanded atomization of citizens, in my mind, real fascism, by the way, is countered in a thousand different ways by the distributive and expansive forces of liberty and technology. The American government, long off the constitutional leash, seeks to attack both pillars. First, it seeks to utilize these same technologies towards its own ends, and second, it seeks to destroy uniquely American ideas and ideals of personal liberty and natural rights. The real war is being fought on both fronts, ideological suppression and warping of ideas of liberty, along with tech and AI-enhanced manipulation of information, biological, mechanical, and monetary systems. This is what truth seekers, liberty advocates, revisionist historians, and the rest of us are up against. And yet we are winning. This conference, its topics, its speakers, its attendees and viewers attest to that. We are winning in part because we are in the business of maximizing and sharing the truth about state actions, past, present, and future. But if we are winning, why do we see more wars and more plans of wars and more persistent wars? Why do we see more and more egregious state clampdowns on free speech, technology, and trade? Why do resources seem so precious and limited if we are a nation as if we are a nation in the midst of a siege? Randolph Bourne has the answer to these questions War is the health of the state. Thus, the health of the wars is an indicator of the health of the state. It makes sense that a weak and morally impoverished state would conduct a long series of costly, unpopular, and society-busting, not to mention illegal, wars. We can examine the ugly and deceitful history of American involvement in World Wars I and II, but if we look at the era since then, notably where Congress has not made a single deliberative declaration of war, we must diagnose an extremely unhealthy state. The U.S. government is frustrated and angry, and it increasingly sees we the people as the enemy, filled with dumb animals to be manipulated and smarter ones to be eliminated. As a military officer in the Pentagon, I didn't understand a lot of what I was witnessing. The absence of a constitutional order, the lies blatantly and even carelessly broadcasted, the evil cultivated inside the great buildings of D.C. It was the opposite of what I had been taught all my life. But as a farmer, I can now understand the state better than it understands itself. When we first started with cattle, we had poor fencing, and we struggled to fix fence, to electrify boundaries, to keep the cows off the neighbors' yards and driveways. Turns out, the easiest solution was to identify the leaders of the bovine insurrection, that crafty minority of cows that broke wire, knocked posts over, tested electric fences before leading the rest of the herd through, and put them on a trailer to the sale barn. We built strong fences in later years, but the real fix was to get inside the herd brain and surgically reshape it. This is the true common ground between Huxley's Brave New World and Orwell's 1984, and it is Washington's 21st century agenda. And the lies I witnessed in 2002 and 2003 in the Pentagon, not to mention those associated with September 11th, 2001, when U.S. government action and inaction that day seemed to give away the plot entirely, were in fact aimed at shaping the American brain and eliminating the problem of thinking people in an erstwhile republic. We are winning today because the state now clumsily and obviously interferes with faith, the economy, money, and ethics. We are winning because we increasingly recognize that the state has designed a military, not for defense, but to stroke the elite dreams of global control and pad the pocketbooks of government suppliers. Infighting, bureaucratic competition, grift and corruption at every level, and the never-ending drama combined to turn Washington into one long episode of the Benny Hill Show. When I watch D.C. from afar, I hear the musical theme Yakety Sax. Boots Randolph, who composed this signature piece in 1963, has become the accidental narrator of the modern American government. So we are winning. I wanted to share my thoughts and experience with government lies, how they are exposed, and if that exposure makes a difference. We can confirm the government lies are ever more rapidly and more broadly exposed by more people, by accident and by design, than ever before. That exposure today, given our interconnectedness, reaches 1,000, maybe 1,000,000 times more people than it did in 63 or 71 or 2001 or 2003, 2018. However, the government still lies, and exposure of those lies, while faster, is not yet fast enough or impactful enough. And while and whole populations risk becoming inured to what the state is doing rather than activated to change or discard it. Recently, a reader told me that we are at the stage where we should be swinging a 2x4 in every direction, and I agree. A 2x4 may be of use as we step towards a future where the state is domesticated, not us, where the state stays inside a free speech zone, not us, where selling a war using hysteria and lies becomes impossible, and where sending American bounty to a war promoted by other states for their own purposes is a non-starter. Towards that end, what might we do? First, keep on what we are all doing in every way we are doing it. Each of us can play to our strengths, and I think we are seeing so many doing that. The unexpected emergence of decentralized, influential, and truth-focused journalism is showing billions of people what courageous and hard-hitting journalism actually looks like. This is being done more cheaply and more effectively than mainstream media ever was. Telling stories is back. Many years ago, I sat for an interview with Dan Rather to talk about what I had seen in the Pentagon. It wouldn't have aired for several weeks at best. It was eventually spiked. Today, most consumed news is source transparent, conversational, and real time. The spiking is left to the viewer's discretion. As Scott Ritter recently observed, Joe Rogan is the new Tom Brokaw, the new Meet the Press. I've been transfixed by a series of recent series of John Carrico podcast clips on TikTok, featuring his incredibly entertaining yet true tales told with a twinkle in his eye and lots of laughs. In 2012, Carrico became the only CIA officer to be convicted and imprisoned for exposing the CIA's enhanced interrogation program. His joyful and fascinating free speech on topics ranging from his CIA days, prison life, and what's happening now, along with his books and films that document his experience, not only inspires and informs, it is a testimony to how we win. We emulate what we see around us. What we see is courage and curiosity, honesty and truth-telling. It is easier and more natural to do the same in whatever sphere we live and have influence. Second, I think we really do have to apply some of the advice of Sun Tzu when it comes to dealing with the state. Sun Tzu advised generals and kings on winning the wars of states. No doubt those wars over 2,000 years ago in Asia were as beset as those today by political lies and the need to murder citizen whistleblowers and others. But on another level, he advises how to recognize power where it may not be obvious and how to use the weakness of the enemy against him. He wrote, "Victorious warriors win first and then go to war, while defeated warriors go to war first and then seek to win. Can we prevent war by winning first? Can we make the thought of war ridiculous? Can we loudly laugh and point fingers at the naked lies of state? Can we refuse to serve the state in its pursuit of war?" The evident popularity of America First tells us the majority of the country has already knows the American war record, not a single win since 1945. The majority understand we don't need war abroad and want the state to stay in its constitutional lane. The other Sun Tzu advice that I really like, and it won't surprise anyone here, is this. If your opponent is temperamental, seek to irritate him. Pretend to be weak, that he may grow arrogant. If he is taking his ease, give him no rest. If his forces are united, separate them. If sovereign and subject are in accord, put division between them. Attack him where he is unprepared. Appear where you are not expected. Again, I think that's what we're already doing, and revisionist history is one of the most powerful tools for irritating, agitating, dividing, and appearing where we are not expected. The state is always unprepared for this type of challenge. The third policy prescription I would offer relates to the first two. Our role of promoting honesty and peace requires active learning and active sharing. To learn and to teach is not really about information. It is about the lens through which that information is processed. H.L. Mencken was right most of the time, not because he had access to different information than anyone else, but because of how he passed that information through a prism of philosophy that was well matched with human nature and human society. Austrian economists are correct far more often than not because their analysis is framed and maturated through a philosophy that matches the reality of human action. Our lens in viewing and assessing the state is better than most. I know of no other group of thinkers that better understand the compulsively destructive capacity of the parasitic state and correctly see this as both defect and danger. Lastly, we ought to work today with the goal in mind of reducing the necessity of revisionist history in the future. We must expect more truth in all forms of media. We must turn away from sources closely connected to the state and towards real people, objective reporting, and thoughtful and based explanations for what we see around us. We must work to deprive the state of its captive and unquestioning audience. If winners write the history and losers do not, we must ensure that the state loses every time. Let's reduce the need for revisionist history by providing the most accurate, compelling, and honest analysis and stories today. The state hates the truth like a vampire hates sunrise. Our government's unwillingness to own its own bad ideas, its failed projects, its crimes, and its losing wars is evidence not of strength, but of weakness. It is our vulnerability to exploit, and on top of everything else, we will have spectacular fun doing it.
Thanks.